The reading today comes from the Gospel according to Matthew from chapter 10. See, I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Be aware of them, for they will hand you over to councils and flog you in their synagogues. And you will be dragged before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them and the Gentiles. When they hand you over, do not worry about how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you at that time. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For truly I tell you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered, and nothing secret that will not become known. What I say to you in the dark, tell in the light. And what you hear whispered, proclaim from the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell.
I almost said good morning. Good morning. I want to begin by thanking you for inviting me here today. It is a privilege for me to be here, and I use that word intentionally because I know that there are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people all over the world whose story may be as compelling as mine, if not more so, who don't get invited to stand in pulpits and share their story. So it is very much a privilege to be here and to share my story with you. And I think as we gather in this safe space, we always need to be mindful of the GLBT people who don't have a safe place to worship and who can't come into a house of worship and be their whole selves. So we will be mindful of them as well. I'm sure you all know that the rate of attempted suicide among GLBT youth is four times higher than that of their heterosexual peers. And I attribute that in many ways to the fact that for many years the message, sometimes the only message that gay youth got was negative. And often that message came from the church. And so I am thankful to be here in a place that is open and welcoming because you are sending a different message to our youth, and you're doing nothing short of saving lives when you send that message. So thank you for the work that this congregation, do you call it a congregation? Okay. Because why not? For the work this fellowship has done for equal rights for GLBT people in this area. When I was in my mid-20s, I was a member of the River Falls United Methodist Church. I was born and raised United Church of Christ, and that irony is not lost on me at all. But I would move from a relatively open denomination to a relatively closed denomination. But when I went to college, I visited the UCC church, and for whatever reason, on any given Sunday, it just didn't feel like the right thing. So the next Sunday, I went to the United Methodist Church, and for whatever reason, on any given Sunday, it felt like the right thing. And I fell in love with the United Methodist Church. I liked their understanding of baptism and of grace. I liked their open communion table. I liked their long history of theological openness and their emphasis on social justice. I liked that I didn't have to leave my brain or my experience at the door when I walked into church. I liked John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, and his devotion to the poor and to the outcast, and for his willingness to preach the gospel in all the wrong places to all the wrong people. It was official. Within a very short time, I was in love with the United Methodist Church. Some years later, my pastor offered a 34-week disciple Bible study program. Some of you Methodist types know disciple Bible study. It's a 34-week program where you work your way through almost all of the Bible. It's a very intensive thing. There were 12 of us, 12 little disciples studying our Bible. And during those 34 weeks, two really important things happened to me. The first is that I began to discern a call to ordained ministry. And the second thing that happened is I fell in love with the woman sitting next to me in class. So people say, oh, I took disciple Bible study. It changed my life. I'll be like, me too. It totally changed my life. And last Tuesday, Val, my partner, and I celebrated our 17th anniversary. So thank you. There's our friends from the United Methodist Church that told me they're at 29 years, so I've got ways to go. But, my love for Val, my partner, and my love for the church were completely inseparable. One literally sprang from the other. Both were life-giving and sustaining. Both were grounded in a deep sense of faithfulness and loyalty, and to have abandoned either one of these loves would have meant silencing the movement of the Spirit in our lives. When I began pastoral ministry, then some years later, I naively thought that I would be able to live this compartmentalized life. I thought I would be able to keep my gay self hidden. I'd seen gay clergy do it for many years. I thought, how hard can this be? Well, the answer came to me very quickly. It was incredibly hard. I was in pastoral ministry for 8 years, and in every one of those years, I felt pulled almost in two. Torn by the church that I love and by the Val that I love. Living divided forced me to keep myself at a distance from my parishioners and from my colleagues in ministry. Lots of pastors love the moment a new person comes to church and you get to sit down with them and have coffee and get to know about each other. I dreaded moments like that because I knew one of the first things they would ask me is, are you married? And I had to say no, and the answer was yes, and every time I did that, I felt like I betrayed my partner. I often tell the story that I had similar discomforts going to clergy gatherings. And I remember one where the bishop was leading this weekend retreat for clergy, and that the first night we were just supposed to turn to the person sitting next to us and share something about your life. Simple enough. But I have this minor panic attack going on already. My palms are sweaty. And I turn to my partner, and before I can say a word, he says, Amy, tell me about the most important thing in your life. Well, I can't tell him about Val. And I can't tell him about her kids that we're raising. So I end up talking about my cat. Now, aside from looking like the most superficial person on the face of the earth, the most pathetic part was I didn't have a cat. So my life and my loves had been reduced to telling make-believe stories about a cat I didn't have. We now have three cats, so I can tell you stories with great authenticity now. The United Methodist Church required me to hide, to fudge, to lie, to deny. It required me to mask my truth. And eventually what I learned was the amount of lying I had to do in order to preserve my calling and my credentials was beginning to harm my soul and my psyche in ways that I was very afraid I would not be able to repair. And finally, I decided, I think of it as kind of like the moment I broke, but I think it was the moment I put myself back together, and I decided that I was not going to live divided anymore. I decided that I would no longer collude with a system that does not honor the very core of my being. What I finally realized was that I love myself too much to deny my truth. I love Val too much to always put her second or third or fourth or even to pretend like she didn't exist. And I knew that God loved us both too much to want us to live this disintegrated and torn apart life. So I began to live out loud what I knew to be true. what I had been taught by the church, that I and Val and each and every one of us are beloved children of God, made in God's image, that God created us and loves us completely. I began to live like I truly believe in a love that will not let us go, about a God who has chosen us, about a mercy that knows no boundaries and excludes no one, about a welcome that is wide and a grace that is lavishly offered. This kind of authenticity has gotten me into a fair amount of trouble. But as we learn from our text for today, we know that Jesus gives us a little advanced warning that there is no way to avoid trouble if you're going to be a disciple. And with disturbing clarity, he lays out the dangers of discipleship. I really like Eugene Peterson's translation called The Message. He says, "Stay alert. This is hazardous work I'm assigning to you. You're going to be like sheep running through a wolf pack. Some people will impugn your motives. Others will smear your reputation. Don't be upset when they haul you before the civil authorities. Without knowing it, they've done you and me a favor, giving you a platform for preaching the kingdom news." Well, as you know, I was hauled before the authorities. My two crimes were that I love Val and she loves me, and that I presided at the holy union of Carrie and Carolyn, two wonderful women who are deeply in love. And these two affirmations of love are considered by the United Methodist Church to be what we call chargeable offenses. I received my first invitation to sit down with my bishop's assistant after I reported in a year-end report that I had presided at this holy union. Now, interestingly, no one has ever asked me why I did the holy union, but I have been asked a million times why I didn't just lie about doing it. So I get to the bishop's office, the bishop's assistant's office, and, he says, I know him. I've known him for years. I like him. He likes me. He said, "So, Amy, you know what happened?" I said, "I did myself a holy union," and I handed him the sermon that I preached and the bulletin that they used and the invitation to the wedding and the thank you note they sent to me afterwards and all the pictures from the wedding, which he thought were delightful. And I said during some point in the conversation, it felt a little disingenuous to me that this holy union would have sparked a conversation with him, because he and every single person in the chain of command had known for years and years and years that I'm gay and partnered. But that never sparked the conversation, at which point Steve, the bishop's assistant, raised his hands as if he wanted me to stop talking, and I've never been good at that. And he says to me, "Amy, you know that you have to admit to being a self-avowed, practicing homosexual." Like I'd never heard these words. I said, "Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I'm not practicing anymore." So he got all nervous. He got all nervous. He's like, because he knows Val too. He's like, "What happened?" He thought we broke up. He's like, "What's wrong? What happened?" I'm like, "Oh no, we've been together for years. We quit practicing a long, long time ago. We're like professionals now." So that meeting then spurred a whole lot of other meetings with with church authorities, and finally I got me an invitation to a church trial. I thought it was good. And, one of the most poignant moments for me during the trial actually came about a week before the trial began. My counsel, my attorney, his name is Scott Campbell. He's a pastor out in New England. He was working on the charges that had been filed against me. So I was being charged with being a self-avowed practicing homosexual. And he was looking for a definition of these words. Now, self-avowal had been defined in our Book of Discipline, paragraph 304.3, footnote number 1. But Scott could never find anywhere in our judicial council rulings or in our Book of Discipline a definition for the word practicing. Now, if that seems really obvious to you, are there any straight people here tonight? Have you ever described yourself as a self-avowed practicing heterosexual? No. I invite folks to just imagine if the breadth and depth of their relationships were reduced to this kind of minutia, if the validity of your love hinged solely on what happens or doesn't happen in the bedroom. So anyhow, Scott is trying to get some clarity on what this word practicing means. He knows what the church thought, you know, what they thought it meant, but he wanted to kind of tie them into a rigid definition. So he wrote a letter to, you know, we have churchy language for all the players in this, but they're just like, so our presiding officer is what we would think of as the judge. So he wrote a letter to the presiding officer, who is a bishop from Mississippi, and he said, I'm writing to request that you provide us with a definition of the word practicing. The respondent, that was me, must know what she is being charged with if she is going to be able to defend herself. Does practicing mean, for example, that the respondent and her partner sometimes hold hands or go to the movies together or name each other as beneficiaries on life insurance forms or visit each other's parents at Christmas? Does it mean that they have established a domicile together? We must know how the church is using this term if we are going to be able to offer a defense to the charges. Please inform us immediately of your understanding of this word, since time is of the essence. Which meant we had less than a week to trial, and we kind of had nothing, so we were fishing. So I don't remember what Clay Lee, the presiding bishop, ever wrote back, but I do remember what Tom Lambrecht wrote back. Tom was the counsel for the church, sort of the prosecutor. I lovingly call him the persecutor. Tom is one of our annual conference's most strident anti-gay enthusiasts. And here was Tom's response to Scott's inquiry. He says, I find it incredible that Reverend DeLong, at this late point in the process that has been going on for over a year, would suddenly want to retract her self-avowal or deny that she is a practicing homosexual. If, however, Reverend DeLong wants to renounce her domestic partnership and commit to celibacy and singleness, the church would welcome that development. That is so sweet. Amy, if you renounce your love, if you destroy your family, if you walk away from Val and the kids, if you stop telling the truth and start telling a lie, the church will approve of you. One of the things that has become so clear to me in the time that I've been working on justice stuff is that the greatest temptation to be untrue, the greatest temptation to be dishonest about who I am, has come not from outside somewhere, but has come from within the religious establishment, the one place we are told that the truth shall set us free. It is interesting to me to note that during the church's trial of me, potential jurors, so these are all United Methodist ordained elders, potential jurors were dismissed from service if they affirmed that their deliberations might be guided by an authority higher than current church law. Do you need to hear that again? They were ordained United Methodist elders were dismissed from service if they admitted that their deliberations might be guided by a higher authority than current church law. Well said. To stand against the temptation to suspend our consciences or to look the other way or to keep our true selves hidden takes incredible fortitude and faith, but stand against it we must. And that's where all of you come in. One of the evolutions that has taken place within me in the past few years is that I concern myself very little with what my enemies are doing. Now, sometimes it's startling to hear somebody talk about their enemies, but remember, Jesus said, love your enemies. He never said you shouldn't have any. Okay? So I concern myself very little now with what my enemies are doing, and I am much more focused on what progressives aren't doing. so often our attitudes about full inclusion of GLBT people are way up here, but our actions that support that intellectual commitment are way down here. And there's this disconnect between our believing and our doing. Here's an example. A retired bishop in the United Methodist Church told me recently that he believes that 80% of the Council of Bishops, so this is every United Methodist bishop from around the world, let 80% of them believe that the anti-gay discriminatory language in our Book of Discipline is dead wrong. The only correction I've ever gotten to that number is that it's too low. 80%, he says. But he said, I don't think there'd be one or two who would say that publicly. And in November, a letter was written by our Council of Bishops telling the whole church that they would continue to uphold the church's discriminatory policies, and it was signed unanimously by every single active bishop. 80% of them think the church is dead wrong in its discrimination, and 0% are willing to stand on the side of justice. That is stunning to me. So what stops them from living into their most noble beliefs? And what stops us? So often it's fear, both real and imagined. Fear is a powerful thing. It can silence our souls and chip away at our confidence and our calling and our conscience. It can convince us that we're fools without the good sense or the gumption to really make a difference in the world. Fear fills us with terror. We are terrified that people will ridicule or reject us. We are terrified of disagreements, of conflict, of criticism, of confrontation. We are terrified that folks will take their money and leave. We are terrified of punishment from the system or of losing any of our accumulated securities. One of the problems with fear is that it distorts our vision. It causes us to see only the negative consequences of speaking up and acting out, but it completely and thoroughly blinds us to all the good that will be done, both in our own soul and in our world, if we dare to live authentically and congruently. But the worst thing that I think fear does is that it stops us from getting involved. It paralyzes us and it cheats us out of being builders in the kingdom of God. When we let fear stop us, we are literally robbed of taking our rightful place in making the world better and safer and more just. Often when I've been in a situation where I have chosen to be vulnerable, where I've, you know, tried to muster up that courage to speak a word of resistance or opposition, and you know those moments, your stomach's turning. People always say, how do you know the right moment when you're supposed to speak up? And I say, when you feel like you're going to vomit. That's how you know. So you have those moments and you finally get something out and you offer that word of resistance and nobody says a word. And then later on, somebody who was there comes up to you in private to tell you how supportive they are. I call these Nicodemus moments. You know, under the cover of darkness, when no one is watching, you sneak up and you whisper a quiet word of affirmation. Have you ever had that happen to you? Have you ever done it to somebody else? Where I was once mad at these folks for leaving me out there hanging, now I just feel bad for everything that was lost. Imagine if, in that moment, they had followed their spirit instead of their fear. Imagine what it would have done for their own soul if they had crossed that threshold and taken the risk. Imagine how the conversation or the outcome might have been different if more people spoke up. One of the things that people say to me a lot is that they're really going to take on a more visible role in this struggle for GLBT inclusiveness. They're really going to start speaking up and stepping out just as soon as, and you can fill in the blank, just as soon as they graduate, just as soon as the political climate changes, just as soon as the coast is clear, just as soon as they are ordained, just as soon as they retire. Translation: I will start speaking out loud the truth I know just as soon as I have nothing to lose. My actions will finally be congruent with my faith as soon as the risk is sufficiently minimized. But the fact is that as long as people of good faith are unwilling to conjure our own courage or act on our good conscience, as long as we collude with mean-spirited laws which violate the very gospel of Jesus Christ As long as we are content to simply wait until the institution tells us that discrimination is wrong, as long as we self-censor or allow ourselves to be censored by others, we will always and forever be the very engine which allows the machinery of injustice and oppression to hum along unhindered. Our faith calls us to risk and to be brave, to prod and protest, to defy and to dissent, even in the face of all the external and internal accounting ledgers which tell us we ought to be cautious and nice and obedient. Of course, the question becomes, do we really need to work this hard? Won't somehow the truth eventually just bubble to the surface on its own? No. The only truth that will emerge is that which we are able to push through. And so we must be willing to literally gunk up the works, to jeopardize our purses and our power and our privilege and our prestige and our popularity right now, not someday, not after we retire, not after the coast is clear, not after we've hedged our bets or secured our privileges, not after we have nothing to lose. We need to do these things today, right now, while it's still dangerous, while it's still unpopular, while it still might get you laughed at or mocked or worse, ignored. Oppression and injustice will only be defeated by wave after wave after wave after wave of small groups of passionate, committed people who are willing to be persistent and who are willing to gunk up the works and halt business as usual. There's a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson that says, a hero is no braver than an ordinary man, but he is braver 5 minutes longer. A hero is no braver than an ordinary woman, but she is braver 5 minutes longer. Don't let fear rob you of your rightful place in making the world better and safer and more just. And Jesus says to us today, don't quit. Don't cave in. It's all worth it in the end. It's not success you are after in such times, but survival. Be survivors. Don't be intimidated. Eventually, everything is going to be out in the open, and everyone will know how things really are. Don't hesitate to go public now. Don't be bluffed into silence by threats of bullies. During my 16-month trial process, that from beginning to end, the whole thing lasted 16 months, I was asked over and over and over again, what are your chances of success? And my answer was always, our chances of success are 100%, because our only goal is to be faithful and to tell the truth. And our chances of doing that day after day after day are 100%. Because as people of faith, we live by a different economy, right? We judge success by a different standard. You can bet nobody, none of Jesus' friends, stood at the foot of the cross that Good Friday and said, well, I think that went well. You know, you can see the evaluation forms being passed out. And what went well? What would you change for the next time? But nobody knew that Sunday was coming. You know, what today looks like an awful failure might ultimately be our very salvation. While it might be tempting for folks to look at me and to see that, you know, when I left pastoral ministry, I lost our parsonage, I lost my salary, I lost my health insurance, I've never gotten any of those things back. It is easy for people and tempting for people to look at me and to just see only the hardships that I have endured, but I stand here as a witness to tell you not about what I've lost, but about all that I have gained. My integrity, comfort in my own skin, a deep peace that comes only from having gone through hell and emerged not in ashes, but fully alive and whole. My days of living divided, of harboring secrets, of hiding my truth, of telling make-believe stories about a cat I don't have, are over. Everything is out in the open. When you take those risks necessary to bring about real and lasting change, the positives will far outweigh the negatives, I promise. The negatives will be predictable, but the rewards will be profound and life-giving, I promise. A couple of years ago, I'd hoped to have a visual aid here today, but so I'm going to have to describe it for you. And a couple of years ago, a whole bunch of years ago, Val and I were on our way to visit some friends in Nashville. And we managed to get from Osceola, Wisconsin to downtown Nashville without getting lost. And then in downtown Nashville, we got all turned around. We had no idea where we were. And Beth and Jenny were the friends we were visiting. And Beth called and said, "Jenny just called me, has this feeling like you're lost and wanted me to check in." I say, surround yourself with clairvoyant friends. It helps a lot. I said to Beth, "We are completely lost. I have no idea where we are." She said, "Okay, can you kind of describe where you are?" I said, "Well, you know, we're sitting at an intersection." She said, "When you get up there, tell me what you see. Tell me what the cross streets are." And we got up to the intersection, I looked up, and literally it said, "Church Street and Gay Street." I said, "Beth, we're at the intersection of church and gay." And she, very quiet soul, screams on the other end, "You don't have to choose." I do the work I do so that nobody ever has to choose again between church and gay, so that no one is forced to live divided, so that authenticity becomes as important to churches as membership and bottom lines. A better day is coming, that's for sure. This discrimination and oppression will come to an end, but only if we band together and only if we are willing to push our worst fears aside and step wobbly-kneed into the struggle, only if we're willing to be brave for 5 minutes longer. Don't cave in, Jesus says. Keep your feet planted 5 minutes longer. Don't be intimidated by threats of bullies. Stand your ground 5 minutes longer. Don't be bluffed into silence. Shout out your truth from the tops of houses. Keep your voice raised 5 minutes longer. We will be brave 5 minutes longer. Amen.